What are some ways to improve bipartisanship in the House and the U.S. in general?
I mean, they got to just get along. Years ago, I had the tutelage. I had the support of Senator Bob Dole. And back when Bob Dole was the Kansas senator and he ran for president, and he was a tremendous leader, he made very clear. He said, Alan, if you win this thing, you got to move here and bring your family here. And I said, I can't make that kind of promise. That's not the way it works now. And he said, the problem is this partisanship. These people, these men, he called them men, they see each other as enemies. Now, it used to be we were adversaries, but at the end of the day, we would, you know, clock out, go to the bar, have a steak and a beer, and we'd resolve everything. And he said, they don't know each other. They don't know their families. They don't know their kids. And he said, you just got to get to know them. So maybe it's making it too simple, but if these people just see each other as colleagues, men and women with the same mission of working together to accomplish the goals and the needs of the American people, you know, get to know them, get to know their family, get to know, you know, what it is that they're there for. You find that, and I think you can find bipartisanship, but you got to want to. So let me say this. Too many of them get elected, and they don't want to. They don't want to be bipartisan because it's dangerous now. In political campaigns, you're either hyperpartisan so you can win your primary, or you're bipartisan and you risk getting beat out in a primary.
Are you concerned with Congress's inability to pass a farm bill? And sort of a follow-up to that is, are there any ways that you're thinking about to mitigate programs that may shut down if they can't get one passed by January?
Let me say this. We'll get one passed. Now, I won't be there till January because I'm confident that I'll be there, but we'll get one passed. There's already the blueprints there. We're going to have to go back to the drawing board, but the Senate created and passed a very comprehensive 2018 Farm Bill. Now, all we got to do, slap a new label on it. Now, it's the 2019 Farm Bill, and we pass in the House what the Senate already passed, which was a bipartisan, comprehensive ag policy. And that's so easy to do. So your first question, am I concerned? Nothing concerns me more right now because Kansas, our livelihood, my family, the people that I call my own, they depend on good ag policy. And right now we don't have it because the congressman, and I'll say this, he intentionally sabotaged and killed the 2018 Farm Bill because of his partisanship. So nothing is of more concern. Nothing is of more importance to me. So primarily, we pass a 2019 comprehensive bipartisan Farm Bill. And to do that, we become a bipartisan working together Congress.
President Trump's administration has recently reached a new trade deal with Canada and Mexico, but tariffs are still continuing. You know, they have $12 billion relief program, but does it look to you like there's any end in sight coming up? And what can be done to sort of stop these tariffs from harming just average Americans? Is there anything that can be done?
Let me come at this from my bipartisan approach. I trust that the president, in his heart, is probably doing what he thinks is best for the country. But because he's got this hyper-partisan Congress and because he's got this Republican-dominated Congress, we're being pulled from the extremes. And so I think that a lot of the advice he's getting, a lot of the recommendations he's getting, these are coming from the fringes. And so I believe that if we gave him a bipartisan Congress, if we gave him a Congress that was men and women that were actually there for the people, the advice, the consent that we give is going to be that, hey, this trade war isn't working as we're practicing it. Let's draw this down. Let's come up with new trade agreements. Let's move forward. So you want to know the best thing to fix this? We get a bipartisan Congress. We get people that know the value of working together. And then that will influence the executive's decision on how to move forward. I think we could end the trade war and we could fix all of our trade agreements, especially with China. You know, like passing TPP, that would have shackled China. We can do that, but we can only do that if we take the extremes on the fringes and we replace them with people that are willing to do their jobs and advise the president on what really will work. That's the answer to everything.
There's been also talk, we can continue a little bit more, President Trump talk. He's talked about sending military forces to the border sort of in response to this migrant caravan moving through Mexico at the time, or currently, not at the time, better way to say that. Do you think this is an appropriate response, and what results do you think could come of this?
I think we're 11 days away from a very important election, and so everything that happens is going to be political. It's going to be motivated by turnout. And if the far right base, if this is what they want to see, then this is what they'll get. What I'm hoping for is the educated people out there that realize it is a concern. You know, 7,000 people coming in without documentation, without paperwork, that is a concern. So how do we address it? Well, I'm hoping that this isn't just a political stunt used by the left or the right, and this can be something that we address as what it probably really is, which is a humanitarian crisis. Conditions in Honduras apparently aren't working out. So let's go to the root of the problem. Let's resolve that. I don't think anything is going to really happen in the next 10 days, except for an election. Let's vote wise, and then we'll move forward with, you know, educated, informed decisions that are in the best interest of, A, the safety and security of this country, but also the people that genuinely need help and the conditions on the ground in each of these countries.
Do you think maybe working with the UN might be a way to approach the situation, or is there another way that you might think that might be a good way to deal with, or do you think we could do that domestically to deal with the large volume of migrants coming?
I think we have to get past this election. I think that that's the biggest driver of this news story is the election. Perhaps the UN can get involved. I don't know that it's as big as that. Perhaps the government in Mexico gets involved. Perhaps the government in Honduras gets involved. But nothing's going to happen until after this election, and nothing's going to happen unless we got leadership that's actually collaborating with the government of Mexico, with the government of Honduras, with governments of any place where, you know, there's political strife, there's economic upheaval.
Internet speeds in rural areas are notoriously slow.
Tragically slow.
Yes. In what ways do you hope to sort of push to improve connection and fight for rural broadband?
Here's where me and the presidency eye to eye. The next generation of telecommunications is 5G. Whoever gets that, they dominate the world. They are the superpower. So 5G's got to be something in our you know, toolkit. You get 5G, and then you invest in infrastructure the way I've been advocating for the past 4 years. You invest in rural infrastructure, urban. You invest in major infrastructure, and we got 5G. And now, at some point, we don't even need wires for anything. We put that out across rural America, and it will save rural Kansas. It'll save family farms. We got technology coming online where the combines need to be connected all the time so you can know exactly where in the field to water, where in the field to cut, where to slow down, where to speed up. All this stuff is vital. But it also provides all kinds of incentives for every other kind of business to come into this part of the world. We get 5G out here and we become viable for so many different economic drivers. So, yeah, we can fix it simply with the courage and the fortitude to do so. It's going to cost money. We're going to have to invest. And so I would do what Eisenhower did. Take Department of Defense money. Take defense money. And you say, this is national security. Some other country gets 5G, we're in trouble. We get it, and we put it all across our country, just like he did with the interstate highway system. We dominate for the next five generations. We need that technology, and we need it all across America. But most importantly, we need it in rural Kansas.
And the president is another – it's kind of hard not to talk about the president. A lot of hot topics sort of flow from things he's said or in things
he's
that he's
trending,
proposing.
He's trending,
yeah. Yeah. But he's recently talked about defining gender based on genitalia, essentially. I understand that a lot of legal protections are maybe not as strong for that aspect of identity as for other aspects of identity. Mainly based on, as some people would say, that Congress hasn't necessarily passed anything on it. In light of this, do you think Congress needs to act and maybe include gender identity as one of the protected classes?
This is a tough one, but I will go to my place, which is, and this may shock some listeners, but I consider myself still to be somewhat of a Barry Goldwater conservative. Now, when Barry Goldwater was asked about, you know, gays serving in the military, that's not the exact same issue, but it's close. Gays serving in the military, and his response, very clear, Mr. Conservative, he said, I don't care if they are straight, as long as they can shoot straight. Now, the government getting involved in this is sort of, again, perhaps it's just political and perhaps there is a real need to address this. But I think that we can only address it if we're willing to actually come together as leaders and say what is in the best interest. And I do say that no matter who it is, they're all entitled to the same life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. We are all created equal. You know, what we become in life is a choice. But every one of us should have equal access to the same kind of protections and the same kind of opportunity. Regardless of how you identify, regardless of who you love, regardless of what you want to do with yourself. That's my solid opinion on this.
And we were talking a little bit earlier regarding the latest poll numbers. Currently, you're seemingly close to neck and neck with Roger Marshall, at least within the margin of error. That's gone up significantly probably over the last month or so. Is that encouraging going forward?
There could be no more encouraging news than this. Getting into this, especially the way I did, because I did this not as a protest. But I did this as a demonstration. You know, I took the Democratic label, which is, you know, that's a scarlet letter in the first district. But I did it because I got to prove that you, that the voters got to disregard partisanship and they got to look at the person. And if they do that, it demonstrates the kind of bipartisanship I've always been talking about. So now you just look at it from the outside. You've got a Democrat trending upward. And right now, I would say if the election were held today, the Democrat, me, would win this race. That is tremendous. Now, I need people to understand that I'm not doing this for the Democrats. I apologize. That's not the way it is. Because if you try to defend half of America, you're letting the other half down. Now, I got to defend all of America. But the narrative, the message of me right now, neck and neck with an incumbent Republican, you know, that is tremendous. But it's the whole thing. That narrative is the whole thing. If I win this, doing it the way I'm trying to do it, it changes everything. And Democrats will benefit from this, but Republicans will too. Republicans have to understand that you will benefit tremendously from electing people who are willing to actually do their jobs. The guy holding the R right now, not doing his job. The guy with the R, not even Republican. He's not even conservative. What he is he's self-serving, he's opportunistic, he's profiting tremendously off of his office. And I'm talking about, you know, the incumbent congressman here. If we can send him packing, at the very least, the message is, you know what? Nobody's too solid. If somebody can come out there with a better message, they're going to replace you, and that's important.
At this point in the interview, I usually like to turn it over to the subject. Are there any final thoughts that you want to share before we close out?
One of the primary issues that is helping my campaign to trend towards a victory, and this is easily demonstrated by any kind of poll, any kind of question you ask anybody out there, the concern for health care reform. The congressman went there with this initiative, this mandate to go and fix health care. And he promised from the very beginning that he was going to repeal Obamacare and he was going to replace it with something better. But he always said this. He always said that he was going to protect the pre-existing conditions clause, that protection that guarantees that if you've got a pre-existing condition, you're going to be taken care of. The fact is he's voted consistently to remove the pre-existing conditions, and he's voted consistently to make healthcare more dysfunctional. Now, you got to ask yourself, why is that? Well, if you examine the congressman's history, he spent 30 years not as an obstetrician. He'll say that, but he spent 30 years as the executive for that hospital. And as the executive, his bottom line was always one thing, profit above all else. And I can tell you time and time again, I can show you testimonials of how he increased profits at the cost of the patients, at the cost of their ability to seek health care at affordable prices. So you've got a man who makes 10 times, he still makes 10 times as much from the dysfunction that exists in the current healthcare system as he does from his congressional salary. Congressional salary is $174,000, and he makes 10 times that in dividends from his investments in the dysfunction that currently is our American healthcare system. You tell me that is a perverse incentive to fix it when it's made you so wealthy. So he, I don't believe, has any real incentive to make it affordable when he profits from it. So if the voters, if the American citizens want health care reform, they got to send in somebody who is not beholden to health care. He's not beholden to the lobby. He's not beholden to the pharmaceutical companies. And he's not going to take a dime from those people because they don't want to fix it. If we fix it the way I want to fix it, it's still very much private. It's still very much free market competition. But what it is it puts the patients, it puts the American consumers of healthcare in control. But that's going to take away some of the outrageous profit that the incumbent has been seeing. I'm the only guy that doesn't have a conflict of interest. I'm going to fix it. And by God, if you fix it, it's got to be bipartisan. Ain't nobody up there that's going to be as bipartisan as me, the guy that has no party loyalty. So if you are concerned about your health care, the future of health care, any pre-existing conditions, the ability to cover your kids, the ability to just to be productive in this society and healthy, then you gotta get rid of the conflict of interest and you gotta vote for somebody who's absolutely saying, here's how we solve the problem, and it just takes courage. Let me connect two things. You said, we mentioned the trend, and the trend line demonstrates that I would say by this weekend, I will be above his 44%. He's held strong at 44%. That's his base, but he hasn't increased. In fact, he's decreased by 2 points. So it's trending my way. The thing that makes this race so viable is probably the farm bill. It's probably the ag crisis. It's probably the fact that the farmers are desperate for something different. So that's worrying me. That is something of great concern to me. But if that's the reason why I'm going to win this seat, then that's it. That's That's the message right there. I will defend the farmers. I will defend rural agriculture. I am a fifth-generation farmer. I don't farm as much as I'd like to anymore, but few people can. I'm a combat veteran, and I think that that is, you know, that's demonstration of service to country. 16 years in education, again, demonstration that I am in this for the benefit of society. And right now, I am worried about my farmers. I'm worried about my district. And the trend line says, hey, that concern is probably going to put you into the congressional seat. So now I got a job to do. Based on this poll, I can win this. Winning it is just the beginning. Then I got to go and I got to do it. I got to defend Kansas farmers. I got to defend Kansas educators, Kansas veterans, everybody in Kansas. And I got to redirect this ship of state. The United States needs to go back in the right direction. It's got to come back together. And so I'm very heartened by that. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to serve.
Alan, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, sir.